Thank you. I call to order the House Committee on Human Services and Housing on today, May 20th, 2013, and we're meeting in circle today. Okay, David.
Yes, but first I just wanted to double check with staff. Is the volume coming through all right? Testing, testing. I've had a particularly interesting life, and I wanted to take a few minutes and tell you all about
it.
Oh, that is a very good idea.
That's a great idea.
That's really smart.
Are we coming through well?
I'm not hearing anything.
Maybe we pass it around.
Some idea.
Oh, exactly.
Okay.
Testing. Testing.
There you go.
Okay.
Well, I just want to confirm that you called the meeting to order.
Yes, I did indeed.
And asked each of us to introduce ourselves.
Sure.
Hi, I'm David Gomberg from House District 10. That's out on the Oregon coast between Walport and Tillamook, but also comes inland as far as Sheridan.
Hi, Donna. Welcome. I'm Alyssa Kenny-Geyer, and I represent House District 46, which is parts of Northeast and Southeast Portland.
Hi, Donna. I'm Sarah Gelser, and I represent House District 16, which includes Corvallis and Philomath.
Hi, Donna. I'm Joe Gallegos, and I represent Hillsborough, District 30. And I'm just interested in how when you take structure away from people, they get giddy and goofy.
Yes. Yeah, much more relaxed.
And you're not gonna... Good afternoon. I enjoyed your presentation, your previous presentation to this committee. I'm Gene Wisnett, and I live in Sun River, but I was born in a cotton mill house with no plumbing in North Carolina.
My brother.
Really, that one would be best.
I'm Gail Whitsitt, House District 56, which is Klamath and Lake Counties, Southern Oregon on the California border.
I'm Donna Beagle from Communication Across Barriers.
Great. And I'm Carolyn Tomei, and I represent Milwaukee Oak Grove and parts of Southeast Portland. So thank you all for being willing to be flexible today and sitting around the circle. I was able to see Donna on Friday evening, and I was so impressed with what she had to say, and there were hundreds of people at this event. And I thought, with us, I wish it were more of a discussion than a presentation. That's what I'm hoping. Because I thought so much about that presentation, and I've got to tell you, I've got a confession to make. I was raised Catholic. I was raised Catholic, so I know all about confession, and confession is good for the soul. So that evening as I went to bed, I turned on the 11 o'clock news, and maybe you read about the baby that was born less than a pound, that was a very interesting story, and the child's grandmother was being interviewed, and I just had a certain gut reaction, and then the father was interviewed. And I had another gut reaction. These are people that I don't know how to put this. I mean, I'm trying to be confessional here and also straightforward. These are people I would normally not have any chance to be around. These were obviously people who were very low income, low education, and I had a gut reaction to that. And I thought, how phenomenal that I had that reaction right after I heard Donna talking about poverty, and especially generational poverty. And that's what I saw from one generation, the grandmother, down to the father. And it made me realize I needed something more personal than a lecture. So I'm going to let you...
My honor. And, you know, the comments that I heard consistently with that presentation and with most presentations is the lack of a clear understanding of what that word even means. So a lot of folks when they think of poverty, they think of somebody who's had a health issue or maybe been downsized in their jobs, and they just need a little bit of help and they can be back up on their feet. And so when we do programming to approach that kind of poverty, which is actually called situational poverty, and we have an epidemic of that right now with the recession, the approaches to that kind of poverty are very different than the kind of approaches needed for the kind of poverty that I come from. And for those of you who weren't at the presentation Friday or Saturday, I gave another one on Saturday to the Rotarians, you know, I come from the deepest poverty in America, and the deepest poverty in our country is generational, and that's what you just described. And that is folks who are born into families that are struggling with literacy. I share, you know, all through school I didn't know the words that people would use. My teachers were talking, but I didn't know what they were talking about. So I would always ask, well, what does that word mean? But because of ignorance of poverty, there would be a message back to me to go look it up in the dictionary. They weren't going to enable me. I got that so many times. We're not going to enable you. You need to be responsible. Go look it up in the dictionary. But when I went to the dictionary, there would be five more words that no one I knew used. So too often that's equated to IQ and not a recognition of the kind of segregation that we have in the United States. And I always talk in my presentations about who do middle-class people spend time with. And we have a country where you can go into any town and call up a real estate agent and say, where are the good schools? We know this, yet it's not often acknowledged. And we don't acknowledge that separation perpetuates poverty and really prevents the people who are not in poverty from a deeper level of understanding. And it prevents the people who are in poverty from having expectations, from having hope, from feeling like they are somebody, that they are worthy, that they are cared about by their fellow human beings. So I usually break down and talk about generational poverty. These are your families that work that day for food that night. I talk about working class poverty, and these are people who are working sometimes more than one job, but they live paycheck to paycheck and they don't have health care. They're usually renting. They're struggling, and they too buy into this notion that all they need to do is work hard, yet the labor statistics show that hard work is not what increases income. Education or a skill increases income in our labor market. So you've got a lot of people, and the census tells this, that two-thirds of the people who fall under that poverty guideline, they're actually working more than one job. And as a society, we tend to say, well, work harder. What's wrong with you? What are you doing wrong? As opposed to acknowledging that without an education or a skill, your chances of earning a living wage are pretty slim. And then I talk about immigrant poverty. And these are folks who struggle with language barriers, cultural barriers, racism, and the poverty issues. And then the situation. So the four I talk about, but in my book, See Poverty, I talk about a lot more because there's so many life experiences that fall under that one word, poverty. You know, and then also there's the federal government, of course, giving us a guideline to say, this is what poverty is. Yet, I mean, it's pretty common knowledge now that that federal poverty guideline is based on a 1960s cost of living and does not include child care, does not include transportation, does not include health care. So when you add those pieces in, the right about 23,000 is what a family of four is considered in poverty, if they're right about 23,000 or less. But if you add in child care, health care, and transportation, that number goes up to about 48,000 per year that they actually need in order to meet those human needs. So I think getting clear about what we're talking about when we use that word poverty as leaders and policymakers, funding allocators, is essential.
Thank you, Donna.
Yeah. Doctor, don't you...
Can we call you Donna?
Please call me Donna.
She does have a doctorate. that sort of puts...
No, I tell people I don't use my title.
Dr. Don.
I'm military. Unless it's to be a voice for somebody who doesn't have one.
I think that what you just described, our society has changed so much. I worked with a homeless council in Central Oregon. And I live in Sun River, and everyone's, you're rich. But we have, in our school, we have a lot of people living in the parks, and their kids are coming to school without any hygiene before they come to school and things like that. But my point is that I think the situation in America now has changed, because it used to be my mother grew up in poverty, in the Depression, but my maternal grandmother had 12 brothers and sisters, so the extended family provided those services that we don't have now. So we've really changed because of mobility in America, that you don't just live with your certain parts of America. I'd still argue you still do that in parts of the western North Carolina and eastern Tennessee and in West Virginia. They still do that and have the extended family, but we don't have that. And I think that's one of the transformations in my life, realizing because of this, we do have to have the state and people taking more of involvement in helping those people. But used to be it was extended family, don't you think?
I think you're right. That's an asset. I always say one of my privileges is my mom would watch my kids. I had so many friends in poverty that didn't have that as a luxury. And so what we have then is an epidemic of latchkey kids. Do you know, I don't know if you know this, but the original purpose for welfare was to ensure that a parent would be home with the child. We as an American society said we do not want children home alone. And now the policies have shifted to such a degree, they're basically, your baby's eyes are open, go to work. You know, and there's just been a recent study that came out about the appalling state of child care for people in our country and in our communities. It's something you'll hear no matter where you're representing is a huge, huge issue. So I think you're right. I think that can be an incredible asset and privilege if you have that capacity, but I think so many don't.
Not now, so it's put a lot more burden on the government and profits to
the
fund.
Very true.
Thank you. Does that reach? Not as well. Okay. You know, over in Lincoln County, 10% of our kids in schools are statistically listed as being homeless. And a lot of what they're doing is couch surfing. So we talk about the extended family, but really what we're talking about is an extended community. But I was thinking about that while you were speaking, and there's been a couple of incidents today that had me particularly sensitized to our youthful disabled community. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the issue of homelessness and poverty, but particularly in terms of kids with physical or intellectual disabilities and how their options might be even further limited.
Well, I can speak to that on so many levels. My 13-year-old has autism. I feel like I have a second doctorate in autism now. But I also have a brother, my younger brother, who was diagnosed in the 60s as mentally retarded. And I've watched his journey. And we don't even say that term now, but that's what it was called then. And I'm pretty sure he had autism, but was never diagnosed, so he can't read and write at all. And what he would do to supplement his disability check, which disability check right now is right about $650 a month. That's how much you get. So what he would do is try to go into Washington State and get bottles or cans and then bring them back into Oregon. So he has an arrest record longer than I am tall for digging in dumpsters, which is theft 3. Yes. So Steve, he tried to get into a janitorial training through Goodwill, but because of his arrest record, doesn't qualify for the training program. So you kind of start to see how these roadblocks get put in place. So certainly, I have a friend at Nightline who was doing a story on homelessness. And 2 months into the story, he had interviewed businesses, he had interviewed police, he'd interviewed people who were homeless. And 2 months after being all over this country having these interviews, he calls me up. He said, "Donna, this is no longer a story about homelessness. This is a story about mental health and what happens to people who are struggling with mental health issues and the fact that there's, in his words, they can be in jail or they can be on the streets." So certainly that adds a significant additional barrier. I also wanted to just share something that I teach around how we talk about poverty and how we talk about these issues. I was teaching a class about how language shapes our reality at Portland State University, and I put up on the board the homeless. And I ask graduate and undergraduate students, tell me what comes to your mind. Don't think about it. I want the first things. And they said, lazy, drug addicts, drunks, and all the stereotypes. And so I put up the mentally ill. What comes to your mind? Crazy, insane, heroin shooters, all the stereotypes. So then I put up on the board, people without homes. And they said, lost their job, had a fire, got sick. And I put up people who are mentally or physically challenged, born that way, got in an accident. And I explained to my students, all I did was put the people back in. So I don't say the poor, I don't say the homeless, because there's no people in it. I don't say inmate, because there's no people in it. I had a graduate student tell me that inmates don't have families. And I'm like, they didn't beam here, and they're not going to beam back up, and we have to talk about what's going to happen in that arena. So I think the labels, and again with children with disabilities and adults with disabilities, we only see their disabilities. Like I've fought for Juliet, my daughter's 13 years of people saying, these autistic kids. I'm like, oh, she's Juliet, and she happens to have autism, and that spectrum is as big as there are people. So helping people to come back to understanding these are our fellow human beings first. And then what their context is of poverty or working class or situational, that's the context they live in. Because I think what happens too with labels and with the media being our number one teacher of poverty is we end up dehumanizing people.
We did that. Was it three or four sessions ago? We changed two sessions. We changed all of our laws that said it had to be people with mental illness.
Love that.
Yeah,
so love that. Yeah, because and if we see the people first, then we have as humans this sort of hardwired nature to want to make sure that people are doing okay. But I think if you can see, you know, the poor, the media have really done an amazing job of teaching the stereotypes. So people believe that people get rich off welfare until you give them the facts. People believe that you can get rich by having babies on welfare until you give them the facts. And then we can have an honest conversation about 23 states. If you have additional children while you're on welfare, 23 states give that newborn no additional support. And the few that still do, that baby will get $60 a month. So I always, in my audience, say, raise your hand if you have a baby. And would you be willing to testify under oath that that baby costs more than $60? Most people are like, that wouldn't even buy diapers. But there's a perception that you're getting rich off welfare. And I talk about in 1986, my welfare check was $408. And that was for me, Jennifer, and Daniel. Jennifer was 6, Daniel was 2. Today, a welfare check for one adult, two children, is $478. So from 1986 to 2013, and I'm given national average. Oregon, it's $506 for a family of three. Then you get about $150 in food stamps. So it's about, you know, a lot of my work is about separating the people from the poverty and really, you know, providing some historical thinking for how did we get to our current ideas about poverty and the people who live in it. And you brought up a really important point about the Depression-era poverty. Very, very different. I've studied Depression-era poverty, and during the Depression era, it was a time when we said, we're all in this together. We have to help each other. So the stigma and the judgment that people internalize that and gain that sense of hopelessness simply wasn't there. Because there was a sense of everybody's poor. Even though, if you study it, you'll see some people during the Depression era had more sugar, more butter, more education, more land. And when the Depression era ended, that's when you see heavy blame and judgment, where people are saying, the Depression's over, what's wrong with you? And not saying, oh my gosh, well, you're educated, or you had land, or you had this capacity. So there's not typically a recognition of that. Men during the Depression era left their families. And there's an excellent PBS video called War on the Poor. And in that video, they have footage of these men in the Depression era saying it was easier to leave their families than to watch them go hungry. because we live in a social context where we teach you're supposed to be the, you know, you're male, you're supposed to be the, but they had no way to do that. So a lot of people look at men in poverty today and say, well, they're deadbeats, they're this, they're that, not recognizing that the boys and the men that are facing poverty in our communities, we have few, if any, programs for them. We act like, oh, their maleness will get them out. It won't, because our labor market demands a skill or an education. And if they're working that day for food that night, and we build in no supports in our communities for that luxury to happen, what we see is a continual cycle.
Donna, can you talk to, Donna and I have talked a lot, so we know each other's stories pretty well. But I'm really curious about if you can speak to the issue of rural and urban poverty, because I think that's something that this state, as we try to wrestle with, say for example, Plymouth Falls has such high poverty, other rural areas as well, and it's different than say the metro area. On the other hand, in Hillsboro, beginning to see more homeless people, and so like poverty moving out of the cities and into the suburbs and into, so I, you know, maybe the distinction between the different kinds of poverty. What can we do? How should we look at that kind of?
Well, it's interesting because the Casey Foundation actually did a 2-day intensive study of looking at rural poverty and urban poverty, and they flew in experts around the country, and I was part of that group, and we spent 2 days with a facilitator just to answer that question. And the question was really, is rural poverty different, so different that it can't be lumped with urban poverty and addressed as a single issue? And after 2 days, the experts from all over the country were in consensus that there was enough similarity that it could be addressed as one issue. And part of that is because for example, I lived in 17 houses in 20 years in Portland. And, you know, I would go get energy assistance sometimes. Because if you're not the first 100 people in line, guess what? There's none. You may as well be in a rural community. So you know, there's enough, you know, this scarcity of resources for people in poverty, even in the metropolitan era, it might appear that the resources are there. Like for example, in Portland, Oregon, the wait list for housing is about 7 years. Whereas in some of our smaller communities, it's 6 months. So you see some differences there. But I think, you know, a core issue that keeps coming up in this discussion is housing.
And all of our shelters in Deschutes County have not come from the state. They've come from nonprofits, churches and nonprofits. We've increased it tremendously. Motels work, especially in the winter, because it's a problem. We started our treatment, our attention to homeless in the winter. The churches would open up the sanctuaries during winter months, and they would trade it around the different churches. But then we've now got a lot more facilities and available to them. It's all. It's not us. And would you talk about? I'm sorry. I guess it's. I don't know what it is, but. I think that we spend a lot of money, the federal government does, and a lot of our rich people that want to help, but they send it overseas. And I have a tough time, since America's as hungry as we are, and as many people in poverty as we have.
Well, I think, you know, a lot of people do believe that you have to go abroad to fight poverty, because there's this, we see the images of poverty in developing nations, and people will say, there's not poverty here. And so I talk a lot about a distinction between American poverty and immigrant poverty, and one of the biggest distinctions, and I've worked in 8 countries, and what you see when you go to developing countries is you see people may have... Developing countries, yes. When you go to see people in those communities, what you see is they have their sense of self. They may have nothing, but they're not like the people who are born into poverty here, and there's a reason for that. So in third world countries, nobody is saying, hey, if you worked harder in this third world country, you wouldn't be poor. if you would make better choices in this. So what happens in the United States, in Paulo Freire, he talks about this. He says, in the United States, you don't you graduate people from college, and they've never had poverty history. So you have people graduating, and what they end up doing is blaming the people for the poverty, teaching the people that they're the cause of poverty. So there's no true recognition or awareness of what real poverty causes are. Like, one real poverty cause is HUD did a housing affordability study and found nowhere in America, if you're making minimum wage, can you afford a modest two-bedroom apartment. There isn't one town in the entire USA. And they call affordability not paying more than 30% of your rent, because the studies have showed that if you're paying more than 30% of your income for rent, then it's going to affect your ability to have transportation, childcare, and other basic human family needs. So when people in developing countries, they're also taught that America is the land of opportunity. So if somebody immigrates to the United States, they often do better in our schools. They often do better in our workplaces. You'll hear employers say, I'd rather hire people who immigrate because they have work ethic, as if they're a better species. They're not, and nor are they worse. But they're in a different context. But the studies show that if they're here more than a generation and they're still fighting poverty, they too start getting those messages. What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? Why don't you have this car? Why don't you live in this neighborhood? Why don't you eat these kinds of foods? Why don't you? So they then internalize the poverty, and then they have language barriers, cultural barriers, in addition, and racism, in addition to that internalized sense of hopelessness. So if you're born in the land of opportunity, I was born in the land of opportunity, but I never saw a single human being earn enough money to pay the rent and utilities. It was always a choice, no matter how hard. People that I grew up with worked incredibly hard. Majority of people in poverty today are working very hard, and they're all making it. So I think some of our core conversation has to be around housing. It's essential. I remember I was privileged. I got a Section 8 housing certificate when I was 26. I was part of a pilot project. It was actually a welfare to work program, and it was a pilot for Steps to Success. And I was in Group 1 of the pilot, and that is such a privilege, because Group 1 got Section 8 housing. Group 2, guess what? No housing available. So when they brought Group 1 people back in to talk to Group 2 people, they were like, you got housing? Your mom watched your kids? Your brothers fixed your car? You know, those are privileges. Those are assets. But the program really shifted away from what I got in that program, which was a very comprehensive approach. And that's what the beauty of pilot programs is. When we do a pilot program, we're like, okay, who needs to be at the table? Where are they? Who are they? We don't try to do it alone. The schools don't try to do it. The health people don't. The justice people. We say, who needs to be at this table? And then we talk about, you know, how do we meet people where they are, not where we want them to be? So if somebody's participating in a pilot program and they fall down, they don't show up, they don't whatever, we go get them. And we seek to know the why behind that behavior. Why aren't they showing up? What's going on there? Maybe there's an addiction issue, or maybe there's a mental health issue, or maybe they needed childcare. But we don't just let our fellow human beings fall through the cracks. So pilot programs typically work because we do those two components. Elizabeth Shore talks about that in her book, Within Our Reach, how in pilot programs we get all the stakeholders to the table and we meet people where they are and we don't give up on them. And I think a lot, 23 years of doing this work, I sometimes say, why isn't everything a pilot? If that's what it takes to get that kind of collective approach and really treating people from where they are, not where we want them to be. Because if you take the same approach to somebody who is experiencing situational poverty, a divorce, a health issue, but they have middle class language, I talk, I said ain't every other word. I didn't know when to say gone or went. I didn't know the vocabulary. I didn't know the examples. So if you approach someone in generational poverty who struggles, my family members can't read and write. And so if you approach somebody like that with somebody who's grown up in a middle-class environment, then what's going to happen? You know, typically what happens is the person from situational poverty will be able to make it back on their feet. But the person from generational poverty will go, well, they didn't really want it. Because we don't acknowledge that they're coming into this setting in a very different place. And all of these types of poverty experiences are addressable, but not if we're not conscious of it.
I think it helped you more than anything was a house and
talk. Well, it was house. That's interesting, because over the last 23 years of speaking to lawyers and judges and doctors and teachers, I've had consistently so many people come up to me and say, what was the one thing? What was the one thing? And I'm always like, wouldn't it be so cool if it were just one thing, right? And so it's a multifaceted approach to address the complexities of poverty. So the self-confidence, if you read my bio, it doesn't say, you know, GED. I got my GED at 26 first. It doesn't say associate's degree first. It says self-confidence. Because until I realized that I was somebody and I had something to offer, you could have put opportunities in front of me all day long. And because I had internalized that I wasn't smart internally, well, it began in that program, that pilot program with four. There were four people running the program, and I was actually homeless while I was in the program with my kids. We got evicted. We became homeless, and it didn't matter because every day when I went there, they were giving me a four-letter word. Can anybody guess? Hope. Hope. Hope is the wings. So I'm getting these four people. I had never heard a middle-class person's life story, ever, ever. And they stood up and told their life stories. And I was like, you lived in one house your whole childhood? You went to one school? You guys didn't go hungry? Your family members didn't get arrested?
Donna, talk more about what life was like for you. I think, you know, we're seeing this woman who's very well-spoken, very attractive, well-dressed.
Thank you.
PhD, and speaks all over the world, literally. So talk about what, because I think those of us who have been social workers, and those of us who, we're here in the Human Services Committee, and I've been doing this for almost 14 years, so we hear people for whom it's very difficult, who it's hard to reach them, and it's hard to make changes for them that are lasting. And it seems like people get frustrated, like, we keep trying with this family or whatever, and we're not getting anywhere. So
yeah.
That I remember one of the things I read about you, you said it was like a different, did you say planet, or was that just in my mind? That this is a different world out
it
here.
Is,
Your
it
world is different from any that we have experienced. Joe, I know you came from a migrant family. My father was a horse trader in Appalachia. So there was some of that for me, but nothing.
Well, I have a question pertaining to this. Why do you think the educational system let you down? You obviously have the same opportunities to go to school, I would assume, public school, as middle class or wealthy or, right? I mean, aren't children in poverty, do they go to the same schools that everyone
does? No. Remember what I said earlier, that you can call up a real estate agent, and we could do this right now. If there was a phone here, I could call a real estate agent and say, hey, I'm in Salem, Oregon, thinking about moving here. Where's the good schools? Do you see the...
I went to a tour school, and mm-hmm. I sat in there with as did my husband, from the time I didn't go to kindergarten, it wasn't offered. And so I sat in a room with first through fifth grade, and the teacher was teaching about 12 children. And it was not, I mean, it was extremely rural, extremely poor. And yet I came out at the end of first grade with a sixth grade reading ability. Nobody worked with me outside of school. And we had migrant children with the landowner's children, etc. So I have a hard time understanding exactly why we don't all have the same opportunity when I see how it happened for myself and my husband.
Mm-hmm.
So in schools that weren't what you would call great schools.
You know, well, one thing that I'll say right off the bat is in generational poverty, there's a high mobility. So you're evicted. I mean, I would go to 10 schools in a year. we were constantly evicted. We'd get up enough money to pay maybe 1 month's rent, then it would take them a while to get us out, but then to get us out, we had to move to the next community.
Was it
mobility?
Discontinuity between schools that you couldn't?
Oh.
What they were doing in first grade?
No. I always tell people that how smart I was depended on where I was going to school. And it was interesting because most of my memories are Oregon and Arizona, a little bit in California and a little bit in Washington. But my family lived in Duford, Mill City. We lived in Independence. We lived in Dallas. We lived in Newport. We lived in Tillamook. We picked moss in Tillamook. We lived all over the state. And my parents were picking, you know, potatoes and the grapes and the onions and the pine cones and the bark and the mushrooms, and that's how we survived. So, but it was interesting because when I was a kid, we lived in Brooks, Oregon for a while. I went to Brooks schools. But when I went to school in Oregon for a month or two, usually I get to go, and then I would go back to Arizona. Oh, I was always the dumb kid in Oregon. I was always the dumb kid. But when I would go back to Arizona, I'd be the smart kid in West Phoenix, Arizona, because I had already done some of the work that they were doing. Oregon schools used to be ahead of the game. And so even in the high poverty communities. So in my school experience, it was high mobility. There was low expectations. And I work in schools every day, just about every day of the week. And I'm constantly teaching that teachers will say, should I lower my expectations for kids in poverty because they're fighting so hard? And I say, no, they're already too low. There's extremely low expectations for kids in poverty. And some people say, well, I had them for 7 months and then they quit. So we start determining who we think is going to make it. And then what you end up having happen is, you know, less energy going to the ones, and this is true for special ed kids too. There's a sense of, they're overwhelmed and overworked. And then you go into schools with high violence, which I never went to school that didn't have lots of violence ever. I was beat up. I was made fun of for my clothes. I was sharing the story earlier about a first grade teacher when I was in seventh grade. I was in the school principal's office after being beat up. I had told the teacher, I don't want to go on the playground. There's fights out there. And she said, I have the work to do. You need to go outside. I went outside. I got beat up. My hair is falling out. I'm in the principal's office. And this teacher said, I'm a first grade teacher. And instead of going out there where there's fights, why don't you come into my classroom and read to my first graders? And I was sharing this story that's the first time I ever felt like someone actually cared. So, and that was also the first year I ever went to one school for 1 year. It was seventh grade. I was in that same school. So I think that there's differences in curriculum. I lived in outer southeast Portland with my kids, and our house was broken into 5 times in a 4-month period. So the landlord felt sorry for us and rented to us a place he owned in Park Rose. And I moved my kids from outer southeast to Park Rose. And the first thing I noticed was the kids were bigger, because Park Rose used to be fairly middle-class community. It's shifted now because it's the second ring. But the kids were bigger, and my kids were bringing home actual work. Whereas before, my son was in kindergarten. He was just coloring, and over at Park Rose School, he was actually doing work. So I noticed a distinct difference just in my own kids. But you see schools with a lot of children who are struggling with poverty with the fewest resources. There's this sort of assumption that they're going to get somewhere out there in the community their vocabulary, somewhere. You know, I always say, what do we call homework when you don't have a home? So you got kids who go home and they have parents who are able to read. Parents who are, and sometimes it's language, but we send stuff home, and the kids who don't have that capacity, they come back in. I share a study that came out of Stanford, and they had surveyed middle-class parents, and this was on homework, and they reported that over 90% of the middle-class parents said that they either did their kids' homework for them or with them. And so I always say to teachers, who are we grading? Yeah, I was working with another school doing a poverty competency assessment, and this teacher said to me, you got to help me with this one boy. She said, I've tried everything. And I said, well, tell me what you've tried. And she said, I took away recess. I don't let him have extracurricular activities. He's not allowed to do any athletics, and he's still late every day. So I always ask how, in my audience, is how many of you are on time when you're in crisis? You know, we're often punishing students and families who live in crisis. And what Herbert Gons in his book, War on the Poor, he says, we ask people who are in crisis to act middle class. And they, you know, they don't have the capacity to do that. We, even in the court system, you see the same thing. It's like, okay, well, go get drug treatment, then you can have your kids back. Well, if you're privileged and you have an addiction, you can go, you know, for treatment and rehab. But what if you're in poverty? What's our nation's answer to meth for people in poverty? Yeah. It's jail. I train drug and alcohol counselors, and I'm like, hey, is jail going to cure meth? I'm still waiting for one of them to go, yeah, that'll work. You know, so, and then you start looking at communities that are addressing this horrific drug that's destroying families, and maybe it's a 5-day rehab program. Some of them will do a 30-day rehab program, but there's a 9-month wait list. So if you get lucky enough to get in and you do 30 days, you get out, and what do you think is going to happen? You don't have to be a drug and alcohol counselor to know they're going right back to it.
And that then, was sort of your question, wasn't it, this, yeah. Wasn't it last week about meth people going into prison, and they're still, they come out, they're still addicted
there's
to
no
meth.
Treatment. So, there's no funding.
There's no treatment, yeah.
So what we say to people, though, when they do if they get 30 days, we'll go, you didn't love your kids enough. You didn't really want a better life. But the research shows that if you're addicted to methamphetamines, it takes a year of intensive rehab to be free of that drug. We gave you 30 days. You know, I always say what we should be saying is, man, we gave you 30 days. Can we start over? Clackamas County has a groundbreaking program going on. It's in its fourth year, and they have people coming from all over the country to look at this meth rehab program. They're doing a year-long intensive meth rehab. But what the irony is that this isn't new research. You know, this is 20-year-old research showing that it takes a year of intensive rehab. But it's like this big, you know, somebody's actually implementing what it's going to take to be free of that drug. People will say, why do people smoke if they can't afford, you know, food? Why are they smoking? And I say, because the tobacco settlement dollars didn't go to buy Nicorette for people in poverty. It's an addiction. I work with smoking cessation programs at the federal level. It's as addictive as heroin. It calms nerves. It suppresses appetite. You know, and you've seen a drop in smoking for middle-class people who can buy Nicorette or go to the doctor and get that Chantix or something. Those folks are getting off of the addiction, but the people who have no access to that, their smoking rates are up. So again, it's an addiction, and so we treat it as a behavior, like alcoholism. Alcoholism is a disease. We have enough literature to show alcoholism is a disease. Yet, what do people do who are in poverty? Mm-hmm. What's our community's answer to that disease of alcoholism? Again, if I'm privileged, I can go to Serenity Lane. If I'm Britney Spears, I can go to the Caribbean. $40,000 a month is what she paid. But if I'm in poverty, you know, what I saw happen to people who had the disease of alcoholism was I saw them get 2 hours of detox if they were arrested. And that was it. So we treat it as a behavior and we say, stop it. But it's a disease and it's proven by research that it's going to take treatment. So again, some of those socioeconomic dynamics play into the fact, you know, and people will sometimes say to me, well, the reason they're poor is because they're alcoholics. Mm-hmm. And I have to tell them that the studies show the number one group that struggles with alcoholism is not people in poverty. It's actually lawyers. Wow. They have the highest alcoholism in our nation.
Could we go back to what Gail had talked about?
Sure.
I'm still sort of puzzled about that. Gail, you were talking about sort of a one-room schoolhouse.
Right, but minimal amenities, etc. Virtually, right. Why is it that Gail did phenomenally well in that study, and people who would, especially generational, have a hard time bringing in, even in urban school, that might have? Right, you know, we had like an hour for each grade, if you will. So we were lined up by, you know, first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, and the teacher would teach to the little kids in the line. So I would say I probably had between an hour and a half of instruction a day. But what I did was I watched her teach all of the rest of the kids. But she had to teach, that one teacher had to teach to five different grades in a day. And we would all watch what each other, because we had to be quiet and we had to sit there and watch. And so essentially I got 5 years worth of education in 1 year. And it wasn't just me. I mean, there were other...
We also talked about the classroom size being, I mean, that's equivalent to a private school to have 12 kids.
But only 1 hour for our teaching to us. So it was actually less than you would have normally, you know, for the children in those ages. So, I mean, I really understand what you're saying, and I think the most important thing that you can do for children is to teach them their own value and their own self-worth and tell them they can be what they want to be if they work hard enough. You give them the self-confidence, and you alluded to that earlier, that you teach them of their own worth and their own value, and that is something to really instill in them.
Well, you're absolutely right, but it requires more than telling. So, you know, if somebody, I remember when I was getting my bachelor's degree, people said, Donna, you could get a master's degree, and I was like, no way. That's for smart people. No way I could ever do that, ever, ever, ever. Smart people get that. And so I would be talking to people, and my counselor at the time at University of Portland, he's like, Donna, you could get a master's. You have a 3.91 GPA. You could get a master's. You're smart. And I'm like, no, I'm not smart. And he said, Donna, you're here at the university. How could you have that kind of grades if you... And I said, well, my professors, they like me. And he said, they're not going to jeopardize their careers for you. It wasn't enough to be told. What happened was I started meeting people who had master's degrees and having an opportunity to talk to them. And I would talk to people for a while. I'd be like, you have a master's degree? Alrighty then. I can get a master's degree. So the concept there behind that, the theoretical concept, is a concept called identification. So a scholar named Kenneth Burke talks about, when I identify with someone, when I see how I'm like them, and they see how they're like me, that gives me the ability to see through their eyes. So what happens, you know, I tell people, at 15 I quit school, Marshall High School, dropped out. I tell people I never knew a soul who graduated. And I never knew a soul who used education to earn a living. I never knew a soul who benefited from education. The meaning of education was very, very different for our family. So people would say to me, but wait a minute, Donna, you knew your teachers. So here's where identification comes into play. Being in the room with someone is not identifying with them. So my teacher said to me when I quit school, I said, I am so out of here. This stuff has nothing to do with me. I'm getting married. I don't need this. And she said, wait. You're going to want a job. So here's another concept that's really important. Meanings are in people. Words are symbols. Words don't mean a thing. We as humans give meaning to those words. So what is the meaning of a job to a teacher? What would you say? The meaning of a job to a teacher?
Home, a car.
Stability, right? You know, probably pay your rent and probably or own your home maybe. You can probably, you know, they're not overpaid, but probably could have car insurance and food in their fridge and health needs and transportation needs and maybe have a vacation. And one of the really cool things about being a teacher is you get, like if you're at a party and you say, I'm a teacher, people are like, aw, right? Because we have society, Max Weber would say societal honor. You get societal honor, which is something we humans need. So from the teacher's perspective, she's using a motivator that is like, yeah, why don't you want this too? This is awesome. And I'm looking at her from generational poverty life experience. And she's saying stay in school to get a job. Well, what's the meaning of a job to a migrant labor worker? You work hard, you don't get treated with respect. I never saw a soul move up. I never saw anyone make enough money to pay their bills. So I saw people work hard my whole life, still get evicted, still go hungry, be treated. The only thing a job ever did for the people in generational poverty is take them away from their family. And your family's in crisis. They need you more than ever because they're in that war zone of poverty. So I looked at my teacher and said, I don't want a job. Now, from a middle-class perspective, how do middle-class people respond to that? When someone says, I don't want a job, what do we say?
Lazy.
That's exactly what she said. You're lazy and you're just not motivated. I went from GED to doctorate in 10 years. And I hear this all the time. People in poverty are not motivated. They're not motivated. I say, you're not using the right motivators. So in my doctoral research, I interviewed people from generational poverty who achieved bachelor's degrees. Because I couldn't find their voice in the literature, for one. We rarely, if ever, hear from people from generational poverty. And I asked the question, what did education mean to you and your family? The number one response, stress. The stress of getting there. The stress of having the right clothes, backpack, shoes. The stress of not knowing the words. The stress that my family's already stressed out. Now additional stress for having to pay for the sport fees or the stress on the family. So, you know, the meaning of education, the meaning of a job. And when I do teacher in services, we focus on how do you help kids see the purpose of education? Well, you have to make it relevant to their context. So what I say to kids, how'd you like to buy your mom a house? And they're like, I'm all right. There's two ways you're going to do that. I'm not going to lie to you and tell you hard work's going to get you there. How many of you have seen people work hard, still get evicted? Hands go up. Okay. So you know that's not the answer. So what is the answer? The answer is you get a skill, you get educated. That's it. That's what our labor market demands. And, you know, I always say, who works harder, the migrant labor worker or the person in their cube? We have this notion that if you work hard in the American society, you will
get ahead.
Get ahead. We'll print out the labor statistics, and the labor statistics say, no, you won't. No, you won't. You look at somebody who takes a minimum wage job, if they don't have education, and they define uneducated as high school or less, and they define unskilled as, like, you're not a plumber or electrician or some of those jobs that can get you a living wage job. So if you take a minimum wage job and you work for 10 years, the average increase in salary for an uneducated, unskilled worker is $2 per hour after working 10 years. Doesn't matter how hard they work. And in variables that increase income in the American labor market, hard work doesn't show up there. Because if it did, we really would have to explain who works harder, the person cleaning hotel rooms or the person in their office. It's not about hard work. It's about, do you have skill? Do you have education? And then guess who's least likely to get those things? Mm-hmm. People who are working that day for food that night.
So let's turn that to the other side of the coin, if we could, for a moment. Because we have plenty of economies in the state of Oregon that depend on minimum wage jobs or jobs that are close to minimum wage. And how do we create an environment where people can move through those positions toward a living wage future? And how do we incentivize people to at least take the first step to take that job as opposed to not taking the job?
Well, I think there's some really incredible models and exciting possibilities for doing just that. You know, I'm a perfect case study of that. But for me, it was I needed to get some education under my belt before I worked at Pizza Hut. I still got evicted. I was leaving my kids alone, and they were seven. And like, I don't want, that's not the world I can take. So I think we have to, as a community, we have to begin thinking about, okay, how can we build in the luxury? And I think learning is a luxury. How can we build in the luxury to gain a skill or luxury to get an education? For me, being in that pilot program, I got that Section 8 housing certificate. I was about to say, I remember when they gave that to me. I mean, Maslow was right. I remember how much of my brain was going toward, where are we going to sleep tonight? Because my mom and dad lived in a trailer on 82nd Avenue, 10 foot long. My dad was invalid. Two of my brothers and their families already lived there. I had nowhere to go. So if I got that Section 8 housing certificate, and I remember that was the moment when I could actually think about maybe that all that GED stuff they've been talking about, maybe I'll try that. I couldn't even get there before that moment. So I think you've got people in different places, like we talked about, you know, different levels of poverty. And I think we have to find employers who have tracks for people to move up and gain skills while they're working. If they, you know, if they're working and they're gaining those skills so that they can be skilled labor workers, and we build that into the workplace.
I think that's a good answer. I think tracks that lead toward improvement are a good answer. Yeah, I live in a community that you talked about housekeeping. I live in a community that's got more oceanfront hotel rooms than any place between Seattle and San Francisco. I've got record unemployment, and I've got help wanted signs all over town. And I'm trying to reconcile those two things. And, you know, in my own small business, now, we pay above minimum wage. I should make that very clear. We pay far above minimum wage. And yet, I've had people that come in, they've worked one shift, and they said, you know, working isn't for me. So how do we reconcile that, and how do we incentivize people to take that first step that's going to lead them toward the kind of track you're talking about?
You know, I can't know what's the why behind that statement, but I do know that when you're in that war zone of poverty, there are lots of bullets flying at you. And you know, I use the metaphor of war because if you study poverty, that metaphor is used throughout history because that's what it feels like when you can't get medicine and you're watching people you love go hungry and all of the things that hit you. So who knows what's behind someone saying something like that. Maybe they have somebody in crisis at home like my brother Melvin. My brother Melvin married a woman named Matilda. She had three children. She was diabetic, severely diabetic, the insulin kind. And when they married, she lost her medical card because she was on welfare. So Melvin's working minimum wage. And she ends up, there's no money to buy the insulin, there's no money to buy the needles, so she's reusing it. What happens to her is at age 35 she has a massive heart attack, which paralyzes one side of her body at 35. So Melvin comes to me, he's got tears in his eyes, and he's like, Donna, I have to divorce my wife. It's the only damn way I can get her health care. So they divorce and they begin living together, and they lived in Washington. And Washington has a step-parent law that says when you marry somebody with children, you become liable for those children financially until they're 18. So when they divorced and began living together, the state of Washington began billing Melvin for child support. How much is he making? Minimum wage, right? So what happens is his employer gets irritated that he has to deal with the garnishee wages and then ends up firing him. And then Melvin gets another job, but Till is so sick she can't take care of the kids, so he keeps having to leave because she's in crisis. And so he looks like a pathetic worker, but I've never met a harder worker than Melvin. But he's got all these things. And, you know, they ended up homeless, and they ended up, I mean, she ended up, eventually he caught so many different jobs, and he was constantly fired for having to leave to go take care of his wife because there was no community. He was it. He now had a paralyzed wife, and he had three kids, and he had no support. So, you know, he ended up not working at all. He signed up as her caregiver, and she was on Lifeline from that point until she died very, very young. And people in poverty do die very, very young, way ahead of middle-class people. A lot of people say, well, the reason they die young is they smoke too much, they drink too much, and they don't take care of themselves. But the federal government did a study of those early deaths, and they found it's actually only 13% of early deaths can be attributed to that. The early deaths by social class are attributed to living in polluted neighborhoods, working in unsafe jobs, the lack of access to health care, and the stress of health care, which they found affects immunity, which is another thing that affects employment. People are sick more in poverty. And that sense of hopelessness that I talked about, that you internalize, that what's the point of trying? So a lot of people in generational poverty are there. I call them curled up human beings. And in my programs that I do, like I do these education programs for people in poverty to remove the shame, rebuild the hope, and reduce the isolation. And I in one day can get at what you're talking about and help people see that they're not the cause of poverty and begin to build that confidence. But we have to start in a different place with folks who are in that situation and have been programmed and socialized that's where they belong and that's all they are. So there does develop this why try or why would I want a job, and often that's entrenched in that internalizing something's wrong with me, why try? Because really hope is the wings. If you put an opportunity in front of me, hope is the wings for grabbing that opportunity. And if I'm working and I'm still getting evicted, you know, and we could come back again to affordable housing. So even though they may be working, actually, I believe the last number that I saw was $16 an hour is what a single person in Oregon needs to not be in poverty. So you start looking at some of the, what actual cost, and at the coast, what would be the actual cost of living there? I'm not sure in your community, but that'd be a great discussion to have about where's the community in terms of housing? Where's the community in terms of childcare? Where's the community in terms of access to dental? Dental's another huge issue. I think you probably know that the number one cause of school absences in our state is kids with dental problems, and it's even worse for the adults. They can get them pulled out. That's about it. And then, you know, we say, well, if you have bad teeth, you must be a drug addict. I have a cousin who just got her teaching degree, and she cannot find a job. Nobody will hire her. Her teeth are rotten. She has never smoked. She never drank. She's never seen a dentist, and she didn't have nutrition to build strong, healthy teeth. So I can certainly understand the frustration saying, well, the job is here. But if the job is here and I don't feel like there's any hope, and if I work, I get evicted, and if I don't work, I get evicted, and at least here I'm with my family, I can understand where that perspective comes from, too.
The issues do we deal with in human services? We've got the other one over there, too, okay. Donna. In our committee that you think that maybe we could benefit from Donna addressing some of the issues of
childcare. I can't emphasize enough, we're creating our future. We're creating our future by how we take care of our children. One question that I ask in my trainings is I ask people, and just do this in Missouri and Texas, and I ask people to imagine what their community would look like if the highest value, the thing that we valued and cared about the most was children. What would the community look like? And it doesn't matter who I'm talking to. People get really excited. Will there be activities for the kids to get involved in? There'd be good education for. There would be no like good education, bad education. Everybody would have exceptional education, you know. And they talk about, you know, what they would see in their community, health care and dental care, and there would be stability for their parents and access to opportunities. And then I talk about what would your community look like if the highest value were senior citizens? What would be in place? And we go through that exercise. There'd be more transportation. We'd actually use their wisdom. I think we're not using their wisdom enough. And then I say, what would your community look like if the thing that was most valued was money? And it doesn't matter what community I go to. They come to the same conclusion, what it looks like right now. What it looks like right now. So I think, you know, getting our community dialogues to be around what do we want our communities to look like? How do we create communities where everybody reaches their fullest potential? I mean, could you imagine a state where every single person in every single community has what Maslow taught, what we know people need to thrive, and what kind of contributions back into the economy they would make, what kind of contributions, you know, I don't know how many Mozarts we're losing. I don't know. I do know that when my daughter was killed at 17 in a car wreck, one of the things I said, she was a senior at Catlin Gable on scholarship, I said, you know, she could speak French fluently. She'd travel to France. They'd send her to France twice. She interviewed at Columbia the week before she was killed. And I said to people, at 17 and a half, my daughter had more opportunity to reach her potential than most people in poverty will ever have. They'll be 60 and never know they could speak French or write poetry or you know, be a teacher or, and in my conferences for people in poverty, they're called the Opportunity Community Conference. We're getting ready, actually Klamath Falls is holding their Opportunity Community Conference on the 23rd. And we'll have people that are currently living in situational, generational, working class, immigrant, the spectrum of ages. But in that conference that is really designed to remove the shame, rebuild the hope, and reduce the isolation, one of the things I do in the afternoon of that program is I ask people, what would you do if you could do anything to bring more income into your life? What would you do? And then I go around to their tables. I wish you could all be there, because this is true economic development. You'll have people say, I really believe we need an infant center downtown because there's nowhere for people to take babies when they go to work. I'd like to start a business and take care of infants. What would you do? I'd like to run a center where seniors could get together and do their crafts and not be alone. And I'd like to be a teacher. I'd like to be a mechanic. I'd like to be... And then I introduce them to the audience with those titles. And then we talk about, okay, what's in your way? What's in your way? And we work through, okay, what's going to be their first step? And then we match them to navigators. And navigators are people who are not in poverty, who are willing to give their phone number to somebody who is in poverty. Because I remember the first time I ever got a middle-class person's phone number. And I remember what an incredible gift it was to be able to call somebody up who wasn't in crisis. You know, I could call everybody I know and love and say, hey, my car got towed. They'd be like, me too. You know, but this was a person, their number never changed. They never got evicted. You know, I still have the little address book they were in. And I could say, what does this word mean? What is it? How do you fill out this form? And I can brainstorm possibilities. So that's built into this model. So the navigators get training on poverty. They get communication and relationship building skills so that they're not judging. They're actually seeing the strengths in people and focusing on what they do know. I do an activity where I say, stand up if you can fix a car. Stand up if you can cut hair. Stand up if you're good with teenagers. Pretty soon I've got 400 people in poverty who came in feeling like they don't know anything. And they're standing. So I teach a strength-based focus. We've got to focus on what's right about people because we spend a lot of time focusing on the problems and what's wrong with people, and we don't see their strengths, and then we don't have anything to build on.
Donna, let me ask you this. I think that I think we're in a situation where ideological chasms cannot sustain us anymore. So on the one hand, a perspective that says, you know, job creation, business, we need to support economic growth. And on the other hand, that we need to make sure we have a safety net and, the public and the government needs to support, you know, Steps to Success and other programs like that. And like I said, I don't think we can sustain sort of the chasm anymore. I think all of us have to recognize that we need to do both. We need to, and it seems like this legislature has taken on the issue of our schools. I mean, clearly our schools have fallen so far behind. We need to support those schools. And as I said, it's not an ideological kind of thing. It really is recognizing that we're all in this together. So how do we, you know, what would you recommend to the legislature to, again, as I said, sort of support that school business? Because all the way from the, you know, learning centers all the way through, I think we need to really look at that issue together. So I don't know, what would you say to that?
But I teach that poverty is not a Republican issue, it's not a Democrat issue, it's not a Mormon issue, and it's not a Catholic issue. It's a human issue. And it really, you know, it really impacts us all. It impacts us all. If you look at the United States of America is number one in the world for putting people in cages. We cage more people than China, and 80% of them can't read at eighth grade level. You go into any prison, and you will find people, if you listen to their stories, you're going to hear poverty, 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 overwhelmingly. So we're spending about $34,000 per year per human in a cage. I always say to teachers, what if I gave you $34,000 for each of your students? How could you do? You know, they say they wouldn't need me to come in and help them, which is cool. But I think, you know, recognizing that it does impact us all. When people in the community are struggling with fundamental human needs, affecting their brains, affecting their bodies, we are going to pay. We are going to pay. It's just a matter of which way. You know, my family, we never had health care. So our doctor was the emergency room. We go to the emergency room, and you don't go there unless you're really, really sick. You know, then you don't want to go to the doctor anyway. You're terrified of them. But when you get really, really sick, you go to the emergency room, and you just hope they give you samples because you can't afford the prescriptions they're writing. So we would share antibiotics that weren't prescribed for it. It's like, here, I had this last year. You take some. You know, we share glasses. I used to take my daughter out of school when I was at Mount Hood Community College. I couldn't see the board because I'm legally blind, can't see far away. So I had no way to get glasses. So I would go and take my daughter out of Whitman Elementary School in outer southeast Portland. She was a fourth grader. And I would take her to my biology class. The other classes I could wing it because the words sounded like the professor was speaking them, but biology, the words don't look and sound anything alike. So I kept failing my tests because there were so many different letters in there. So I would take Jennifer to school with me, and she would copy down everything off the board. And that was how I was able to get through that class. But I didn't have glasses. I have money for glasses. Those are real things that people face every day in our communities. I just keynoted for the Oregon Medical Association, and I had so many physicians lining up saying, how can I get involved? From all political parties. You know, this is not a political, it's not a party issue. This is a human issue. So with the opportunity community model, I'm seeing judges give their phone number. I have people come up to me, I'll share the model in a community where I'm speaking, and they're not necessarily implementing it. And they will come up to me, could I be a navigator? How do I get to be a navigator? The first 32 navigators we had sign up in one community were attorneys. They were attorneys. Well, I'll get my phone number. I'd be willing to call someone up and say, how's it going? And you need some help thinking about possibilities, and you want to brainstorm? And I'll share my network with you, because one concept I teach is we live in a world where it's who you know. How many of you agree with that? Mm-hmm. But if you're in poverty, whose name are you going to drop? You know, that's how people get into good jobs. That's how they get around certain barriers. In my doctoral research, it was identified as a critical piece was finding a mentor whose name meant something. They had a title or their name meant something. That's how people got around things that would have stopped them or prevented them from moving forward. So I teach during the Opportunity Community Conference, I teach people in poverty that you have to have as many people in your address book who are not fighting that evil villain poverty as you have who are, because those are the people who know about possibilities. And I think that's another core issue, is when you're coming from generational working class poverty, you don't even know the possibilities. My son in high school, he's like, Mom, I figured out what I want to do for a living. I'm like, what? He goes, Mom, I want to do landscape architecture and design golf courses. And I remember looking at him and saying, is that a real job? I fly. I'm in some city, USA, at least 3 days a week, and I sit by people on the plane, and they tell me what they do, and I'm always like, that's a job? You know, our kids don't know the purpose of education. They don't know what to do with it. They don't know. They don't have people who use education to earn a living. So I'm constantly in my trainings teaching teachers, you got to be able to teach kids the purpose of education from their perspective, what it can do from their perspective. Because, you know, my doctorate is educational leadership. And what we know is that if you can't make the information, whether it's to an adult or a child, relevant to them, they can't grab it. Part of the way I was able to be successful at Mount Hood Community College, my brother Wayne spent 12 years in prison, and he spent his time reading. So when I didn't know the words in my textbook and what we were studying, the subject matter, the history, I would write Wayne letters, and I'd say, Wayne, we're studying this. I got a test in 3 weeks. Find out everything you can. Mm-hmm. And he would write me back 25-page letters from OSP, and I would ace my test. I couldn't read my textbooks, and anybody that could that I would ask would tell me to go read more about it. So there's just such a gap in the supports and the connections to the kind of supports that can overcome those hurdles that poverty teaches and poverty impacts.
So how do we get people to recognize all of those places where we're making a decision, where we're making a policy decision that makes it harder for kids in poverty to make it through education? I can just think of a couple of examples. I watched, four different kids go through the same elementary school. And in elementary school, there aren't extracurricular activities. So everybody's kind of the same. They all play together on the playground. But in the fifth grade, they do a musical. Everybody's in the musical, but to get a speaking role, you have to stay after school for the rehearsal. And so every single year, that musical is the first time you start to see the group breaking up. You have the white middle-class kids up on the stage, and the kids of color, the Spanish-speaking kids, the low-income kids, the disabled kids sitting on the risers singing in the choir because there isn't the transportation, they can't get there before school. Another example, we heard the equity lens today from the OEIB, but the other thing that we're hearing in educational leadership in Oregon is we need to focus on these STEM occupations because we need more people in science, technology, education, and mathematics because that is what the job market is demanding. And as a result, we're focusing on more advanced science and engineering classes in high school. We're talking about changing our opportunity grant to give more of those grants to dedicate them to science, technology, engineering, and math. But 75% of our kids in poverty aren't even getting a high school diploma. So how do we balance those things and recognize that maybe we need to invest in different things if we want different outcomes?
Well, you said it very well. I mean, we have policies and funding allocations that do not consider the context that our kids and families are living in. So we set up these criteria that people can't meet. And we create, it's part of this has to do with we got to know our history. We got to know where did we get here. In the 1700s, it was illegal to be poor in Pennsylvania. They made people wear a P on their sleeve when they left their homes and said it has to be 4 inches, has to be red or blue, because these people need to be embarrassed and then they'll quit acting poor. That was the philosophy. But if you look, fast forward that to 2013, and I asked teachers, I asked judges, I asked lawyers, I asked people in all these helping professions, how many of you can think of policies that are founded on that thinking? If we can make it hard enough on them, if we can make it tough enough, they will quit acting, right? So we have to get, I've asked thousands and thousands of people, how many of you have had the course, History of Poverty, United States of America? I'm really excited, actually. I'm working with some folks at the state level here in Oregon to incorporate poverty into the state teacher standards and practices. That is a dream come true for me. A dream come true to have nobody graduate from college unless they've had at least poverty 101. Whether they're going to be a social worker, a doctor, from college. I think it should be in K-12, too, because when kids in poverty learn about poverty causes, history, labels, it is just like teaching an African-American child their history. It's just like teaching a Native American child their history. It empowers them to externalize that negative, something's wrong with you. They start going, oh, we're not the only ones getting our lights shut off. Oh, we're not the only ones with no food. We're not the only, right? So I teach it should be in K-12 too, but for sure it should be in higher ed so that you've got psychiatrists who've never had poverty 101. And you enter that perception, into the mix. So you're a legislator, you're a governor, you're president of the United States, and you're making, funding allocations. My welfare check was $408. My rent was $395. I would have people say to me, if you would save up some money, we'll match it, and that will help you get out of poverty. Or people would say things like, we can't give your kids a scholarship to participate in whatever program because you need to pay something. Because if you're not paying something, you're not going to value it. Like, okay, I got $13 here. And I also talk about the federal government. The number one approach to poverty at the federal level is the earned income tax credit. Guess who doesn't file taxes? People in generational poverty who are working under the table, who are working that day for food that night. So that 20% of the population isn't even touched by that policy. The notion, like kids in school, you know, I asked thousands and thousands of professionals, how many of you are on time when you're in crisis? You know, how many of you have the same tone of voice when you're really stressed out as when you're calm? Can we all agree that poverty's crisis, poverty's stress? You know, people are responding appropriately in their environment.
Do you know anything about the Oregon school distribution formula?
Yes.
You should.
This Educate
group,
me.
This group's sitting right here, and I have since I came in this building 10 years ago. If you're a student in Oregon school system, you get X number of dollars.
Okay.
Right? But if your English is a second language, you get 1.5. If you're low poverty, you get another half. Did you not know that?
Huh.
But the problem is that...
You're talking about the school funding.
Yes, ma'am.
Yes.
But the problem is that funding, additional funding for low income or for English as a second language, goes in the general pot. It doesn't go for that individual to help them overcome English as a second language or as low poverty. So we have the right in this, the people sitting here, you could change that.
Well, we have
problems with our school distribution formula. We also have problems in the way that we prioritize our funding. I mean, in this session right now, we debated a bill. I talked to a counselor that's in a school in the Portland area, and he talked about the chaos in the hallways in his school. The staff doesn't want to come back. They're exhausted. And he talked about his caseload. He's got two kids that are in foster care because their parents tried to kill them. He's got some other kids that can't come to school because their mom doesn't wake up. And she's sick, she's addicted, she's not getting any services. DHS is saying they want to be culturally sensitive and not pull the kids out so the kids aren't coming to school. So it's and
there's just, probably more there, but
I'm sure there's more, but the frustration of the kids, if the kids don't come to school, they can't serve the kids. If the kids come to school and they're terrified, are they gonna be safe when they go home at night? There's, you know, what are they gonna do about that? They don't have resources. A few miles away in Dunthorpe, there is another school district where you can go there if your parents can write a check for $12,000, and there in that school district, we've decided it's okay to spend $14,000 per year on the richest kids in the state who are going to be okay no matter what we do for them, whereas at this other school where we have all of these issues, we're spending about $6,500 per kid, and that is our state policy, and then we wonder why the kids in the very small school with the very wealthy families with the big expenditure per kid do really well and go to Ivy League schools, and the kids in this other place who have no access to nutrition, they don't have access to health care, they don't have access to safe housing, they don't have access even to their school all the time, and we only devote $6,500 to them. When they don't graduate from high school, we ask them what's wrong with them and why they aren't performing as well as the very wealthy kids down the street that our state school funding formula and all of our laws favor.
Well,
not that I have an opinion about that.
I think that discussion about funding allocation in every arena, not just schools, needs to happen, and it needs to happen with the foundational understanding of the context which our families are living in, so that when we make these kinds of decisions, that they actually make sense and we get the kind of outcomes that we want. When I went through the pilot program, I came out of there every day a little bit taller. You know, they say, Donna, what kinds of things you done? I ain't done nothing. And they say, wait a minute. You take care of your kids? Yeah. Well, you've done child care. You could run a child care. Donna, when you have money, do you manage it? Yeah. Well, you've been an accountant. And then they had me write down everything I did in one day. And they said, even if it's pick up a shoe, write it down. And I brought it in there. And they had a list of professional job titles, skill sets needed to do those, and then how much they paid. I was 26 years old. I'm looking at, they're circling things on my list that I just do every day as if part of my normal day. And there it was over there. And then it was like, oh my God, there's a title. Oh my gosh, look what it pays. And I'm like, you know, I'm starting to feel like there's some possibility. I'm not so stupid after all. I start getting a little taller. But in that program, they really did take the time. I mean, they would make one phone call, and I would be in major crisis. I was homeless, and they would, and even they couldn't resolve it always, but I didn't feel so alone. So I think when we start understanding the different contexts, so my welfare check's $408. I have $13 left after I pay rent, and this is in high poverty, out of Southeast Portland. I have $13 left. So how did I survive?
You probably got food stamps.
I had $150 in food stamps. And so many people are ignorant about food stamps. They're like, we got to cut food stamps. What does that mean? If you're on food stamps, you get just over $1 per day per meal. But people tend to think that it's, you know, you're getting all this money. $1 per day per meal, and people say there's not hunger in America, there's obesity, which is our ignorance about what you can buy on $1 per meal per day. When you ask people, how many of you buy healthy food, they're like, you know, raise their hand if they're professionals typically. And then you say, okay, would you testify under oath that it's expensive? You know, what would you buy? One loaf of bread for $5 or five loaves for $2? And so you start to, you're going to buy the starches, you're going to buy the carbs, you're going to buy the quick, the easy, the fast. You're in the war zone of poverty. And so you start to understand the poverty causes, then your decisions make sense. So I'm going to this program. I'm getting confidence. I'm feeling like maybe there's a possibility. I get done with the three-week program. I go to my welfare worker and I say, I have an action plan, because coming out of the pilot program, everybody had to have their action plan. Well, they had taken me out to Mount Hood Community College, and I talked to somebody in the financial aid office, and they introduced, this is Diane. She's been here 19 years helping people get money to go to school. She has two kids just like you. Remember that identification? So I start trusting enough to tell her a little bit. And then she says, if you study these kinds of things, these are the kinds of jobs you could get, and you qualify. You qualify for financial aid. And I told her, go pull up her fancy computer, and she would see my credit was bad, and she wouldn't want to help me. And she said, we're not going to look at your credit for financial aid. I'm like, what? You give people money, you don't look at their credit. See, I didn't come from that world. So I'm getting all excited about that. But then I go see my welfare worker, and my welfare worker says, I said, I got my action plan here. I'm going to get that two-year degree and journalism, and then I won't need welfare anymore. And she said, oh, you can't go to school. I'm like, no. I thought, I was so empowered by the pilot program. I was like, she just doesn't understand my plan. So I repeated it to her. No, see, I'm going to go to school. I'm going to get a two-year degree. And then I won't need welfare. See? See? No. Our policy is that you have to be available for every minimum wage job. And if you're in school, that means you're not available. Therefore, you cannot go to school. And if you do, we will have to sanction you. And it wasn't the welfare worker's fault. We, the public, voted for that. So what I said, I was privileged. I started crying first. I thought, I'm going back. I'd had 3 weeks of hope, and I felt myself slipping right back into the war zone of poverty, the permanency of it. And I was like, you know, oh my gosh, I'm going back. And I thought, okay, she said they're going to sanction me. She explained to me, I didn't know what that word meant. It basically meant my $408 would become $258 because they would remove me from the welfare grant for going to school. That is still a policy today in almost every state. So I was privileged. I was able to sit there and go, okay, $258. I can still sell my food stamps for 50 cents on the dollar and pay the electric bill. I'll go to the food banks. I'll run around like to the food banks like crazy. Get the clothes from the clothing closets. I've got that Section 8 housing certificate, so I don't have to worry about where we're going to lay our heads at night. Basically, life won't change for me, so go ahead and cut me. I'm not going back. And that was a moment that a lot of people will never have, because they don't have housing. They don't have that support, and they haven't gained that confidence. You know, and yes, it's fraud. And our prisons are full of people who are doing exactly those kinds of things for survival. And I say in the PBS special, the documentary on my life, it's not about condoning it. As a public, as leaders, we have to understand it so that then we are building the kind of communities we all want to live in. How do we create the schools can't do it alone. The schools can't, the health people can't.
That gets at my question that I'm really anxious to ask. I mean, you know, you're great. And, you know, part of, I'm sure, the perception is, well, you did it. You know, why can't other people do it? But we had what's today, Wednesday? So Monday, I guess. We had a great presentation from the Oregon National Guard. Okay, well, whatever day. The last one, the Oregon National Guard, they have a program in Bend.
And,
yeah, I mean, it's great. I don't know if you're familiar with the program or not, but I mean, clearly the element, or one of the elements that made it so successful was the mentoring piece.
It's critical.
Strong mentoring piece. They pull high school dropouts, kids at risk, and they're very successful with them. I thought it was very much like SEI, sort of, you know, the values and sort of bring. But my question is, that's expensive. And we're struggling here with, you know, school budgets across the state. So I don't think we can afford not to intervene that way. But how do we afford it? I mean, it's like, that's to me the struggle. And that's what I was referring to earlier. You know, it's like how...
Well, you know, it's I do this quiz in my trainings to get people to shift away from this notion of scarcity. And one thing, you know, the things on the quiz are, how much do we spend per year per person who's incarcerated? You know, and it's right about $34,000. How much are we spending for the juveniles who are incarcerated? It's twice, almost triple that much money. How much do we spend on foster care? How much do we spend? So, you know, it's looking at where we're spending the money. It's not that there's not enough. There is enough. It's how are we spending it? And then you look at the public, even in the recession, in the height of the American recession, this current one, we spent $26 billion on Hannah Montana. Billion. That's the B word. We spent, just in March of last year, we spent $1.5 billion on video games. Not the hardware. We spent $62 billion this last year on hand sanitizers. This last Halloween, we spent $800 million on pet costumes for Halloween. There's quite enough, folks. There's enough in government and there's enough in the public. It's how do we allocate it? And our allocation of that is going to come from our consciousness, our awareness of our fellow human beings, what's going on with them, our understanding that we are interconnected. What happens to you is going to affect me. And the better off you can be, the better off I'm going to be. We're connected. You know, these kids that we're losing every single day. A child born into poverty today is less likely to receive an education than a child born in the 1940s. We have made zero improvement on children in poverty. Zero. And it's largely because we don't say the P word. And we don't even acknowledge. I go to schools where they're Title I schools. They're Title I schools, and all their kids are in poverty. And I look at their agenda, poverty's not there. And we talk about a collective, connected approach. You still have health over here, justice over there, schools over there, business over there, faith-based over there. We're not working together. What I teach is, let me look at my hands and see what I can do. What can I do? Okay, I can do that. What can you do? Okay, let's look at you. You know, so that we're really, truly walking that talk of a collaborative, connected approach to deal with these complexities of that war zone of poverty, which steals the potential of our fellow human beings.
Any last questions, words, suggestions, thoughts?
I had one thought when you said, I got nothing. And she was not kidding. I mean, that's how she spoke. And I think about my own prejudice, how when I hear something like that, there's a part of my brain that shuts off. There's something about my brain when somebody doesn't have any teeth that shuts off. They're the other. And I know that. I mean, I'm a socialist. I recognize that. And it's so deeply embedded. It is.
Well, again, because our number one teacher of poverty is the media. So the media dramatizes and sensationalizes and gives real extreme cases so that what you know about poverty and the people who live in it is stereotypes. You know the stereotypes, and we don't see them. We've so dehumanized people in poverty, we just don't even see them. People will say, why do they have babies? And I say, because just because you're in poverty doesn't mean you don't want to be part of your species. We humans have been having babies for a really long time. People do it all over the world. Very recent history, the Western world started saying you got to have money to be part of your species and do something that is naturally human. you know, I had kids. I've had 8 pregnancies. I have 3 living children. Infant mortality rates for women in poverty in America are equal to Malaysia. Our hunger rates for children in poverty in America are equal to Romania. I had 1-pound, 9-ounce little girl. I had a 4-pound girl. I've lost children left and right. But when I had my kids in poverty, had my honeymoon in Cherryfield and Wenatchee, Washington at 15, when I was in poverty having children, the meaning of having kids, I'd love them. I wanted to be a mom. I thought I was here on this planet to be a mom. That was the reason I was existing. Now, in 1998, I was with my second husband, Chuck, who is a senior design engineer. In 1998, he had 15 years in his field. He also had a degree in French, incredible artist, cook. He's amazing, amazing. I'm finishing my doctorate. I'm traveling all over the world. My company, Communication Across Barriers, is exploding. And Chuck had never had children. He's raising mine. So he says to me, what do you think about having a child? And I said to him, Chuck, there's no way we could afford it. Because at that point, I had been exposed to what middle-class people get exposed to. See, society teaches you everyone has the same chance. I thought that meant everybody had our life. Everybody had illiterate parents. I thought everybody had that. And somehow, but through their intelligence and their morality and their ethics, they made it out. We did something wrong with us. Maybe it's our genes. I don't know. I didn't know. Because we don't teach that people make it out by going to the right schools, living in the right neighborhoods. But if you're middle class, you're born, you learn that. You better live in, because if you listen to middle class people talk about having children, what do they talk about? When they're talking about having children, what do they discuss? Do we have health care? Do we have the right kind of health care? Do we have the right house so that they can go to the right schools? Do we have the right car so they'll be safe in there? Do we have the right car seat to put in that car? Do we have the right... You don't get those messages when you've never had any of that and no one... I mean, a car seat, really? You know, who has that? I remember I bought my son Daniel's car seat at a garage sale for 25 cents. Didn't have any buckles on it or anything. And I ended up getting a ticket, going to court. Donna Beagle, you are charged with endangering the life of a child. I had no idea. So I felt like I had received, once I started having interactions with middle-class people and realizing they weren't better than me, they weren't better than me. They had different experiences. They had different exposure. Once I got that piece, then it was like, okay, maybe I can get that GED, that 2-year degree. Just realizing they're just people, and who've had different, you know, lived in one house or whatever, you know. So, and realizing that that is how people make it ahead. People make it ahead by living in the right neighborhood, by going to the right schools. And there's the exceptions, but it is an exception. It is an exception. Our labor statistics are clear. Our education statistics are clear. Children in poverty, adults in poverty. I have adults come up to me in the opportunity conference and they'll say, I'm 46, Donna, what could I do? I say, you could be 50 with a bachelor's degree. Or time's going to go by anyway because, you know, your labor market demands it. I have people tell me in those conferences, I ain't smart enough to go to school. And I tell them, if you didn't learn when you were in school, it's because someone didn't teach you your learning style. People with autism get doctorates. People with ADHD get doctorates. They do that because someone teaches to their learning style and makes it relevant to them. So I show them a failing report card and I say, okay, is this person going to college? And they'll go, no, yes. This person couldn't read at 15. Both parents not literate. She came to live with me. By 19, she had her associate's degree. Then she got her bachelor's, her master's. Last fall, she got accepted into a doctoral program. The potential in our communities is off the charts amazing. When I see a person who's living in that war zone of poverty, who's saying ain't every other word, who's overweight, who has bad teeth, who has what, I see nothing but potential. And I always say to people, if you saw me at age 26 with a smart mouth, a bad attitude, because poverty teaches you that. And I'll tell you, any human being who watches their mom do without food should have an attitude. They should have an attitude. I understand the attitude, but what I teach people in poverty is how to channel that into ways that it will serve them. So if you saw me at 26, about 40 pounds overweight, saying ain't every other word, homeless with two kids, 6 months of the ninth grade, could you picture me here with a doctorate as an author, as a president of a company? We must see the potential in our fellow human beings.
Thank you so much, Dawn.
More than welcome. Wonderful. More than welcome.
Any last words?
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
From school, many years ago. Probably.
Which school?
Yes, I won't be your wife.
Oh, okay.
I represent Marshall and some of the schools you talked about.
Ned Roche brought me in there.
Yeah,
that's right.
His son and my son.
That was.